There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I am your host, Matt Salmon. As always, so glad that you could join me here for another classic conversation about classic cardboard. Or maybe the conversation isn't classic, but we are talking about classic cardboard, and we will have a conversation about it. So the classicness, if you will, the classicality of our conversation will be determined at a later point in time. Well, if you're a fan of alliteration, you're a big fan of the hard C today. And we're going to go from the hard C to the D, as in Donruss. One of the most underrated sets from the mid-1980s. And we're talking pre-junk wax era. But it is a set that is gaining some attention. And if you're somebody who hoarded a few boxes of 86 Donruss back in the day, you may actually start getting some return on your investment. You know, we've talked about the love for baseball cards, the 90s nostalgia that kind of propped up, although not much, but gave a little life to some of the early and mid-90s junk wax era cards. And of course, with coronavirus lockdowns, especially earlier this spring, many people our age, and I'm talking, you know, typically mid-30s and a little older, going through the old card collection, maybe getting your children involved in it in times of stress and anxiety, just looking for something fun, something that brings back good memories. And of course, you know, going through your childhood baseball card collection can do that. But there's something about 86 Donruss that is starting to get a little bit of attention here. And I've seen prices for wax boxes of 86 Donruss slowly climbing. If you have a sealed box or you have a box that is authenticated by PSA or BBCE or any of those authentic operations, you will get quite the premium for this return here. And while 86 Donruss, I will look at it from the aesthetic point of view and also just kind of the overall view from the baseball card hobby from 1986, we'll also discuss why is it moving up in value over the years. And it has more than just Jose Canseco to credit, although the Canseco rookie card is certainly one of the ones worth chasing in that set. But it has long been one of my favorite sets. I've called it the Max Headroom set because if you recall in the mid-1980s, there was a TV show and an ad campaign done by Coca-Cola with Max Headroom, this, you know, computer-generated, crude mid-80s computer animated character, you know, one of the first instances of, I guess you can call it, I wouldn't say augmented reality because it was totally fake, so virtual reality, we'll go with that. But really one of the first virtual reality experiments that became a commercial hit. And the reason why I call it the Max Headroom set is not only because the Max Headroom phenomena was not only at full speed by 1986, but also just the design of the Donruss baseball cards, the kind of diagonal, scrambly, horizontal hold. And I'll have to explain that to some of our younger listeners, what horizontal hold is. But just the diagonal lines in the background and the very 1986 diagonal cut. If you don't want to call it the Max Headroom set, you could call it the Pee-wee's Playhouse set. because there's all sorts of just 1986 wackiness in the look and feel of 86 Donruss. And I said this in our video post yesterday on YouTube, the one that is titled 1986 Donruss Pack Break. I said that, you know, it's just one of those sets that you could argue was actually the best set of 1986. Of the three major ones, we also don't want to forget Sports Flicks because they were a minor factor in the hobby at that time. And I've always had a heart for 86 Fleer. I've always thought Fleer had, in terms of just really good look and card quality, and often rookie cards too. Topps missed the boat on some rookie cards. They saved them to the traded sets. But I always thought Fleer had the best sets in 1986. I'd argue 1985 as well. I think it goes toe-to-toe with Topps in 84. But you can take a second look at 86 Donruss and really appreciate it. And I'll be honest, I've picked up some packs of 86 Donruss over the last year or so. And when you open them up and you look through them and you realize, you know, there's only 660 of these cards. It's not 792 Topps cards. It's not 900 plus cards from some of the sets from the early 90s. It's a manageable 660, and it is somewhat affordable. No, Matt. Bad Matt. Bad Matt. You're not starting another collection. You're not starting another hand-collated set there. So get your hands off those cards. Put them away. Donate them to Commons for Kids. Put them away. So we're going to have a lot of fun with 86 Donruss here. And also, looking back at some of the conversations that we had about 93 Upper Deck, our most recent show was a very popular one for our fans. Good to see that a Junk Wax era set is still getting love, and not just from people who, like myself, just talk into a microphone for roughly an hour or so, pontificating about those great sets from the mid-1990s. But great to see some reaction from the hobby, too. A lot of people still enjoy 93 Upper Deck, so I'm glad that we were able to make a positive connection there. Now, why did we select 86 Donruss for this week's show? Simply because we went the scientific route. Yeah, we put a poll on Twitter, at Wax and Gum Stains, and just barely edging out the 1982 Topps Kmart 25th Anniversary MVP set, which surprised me. I'm not surprised 86 Donruss was the number one pick. I am surprised by the vote here and how close it was. So close that the RNC was about to file a lawsuit. Oh, I'll leave politics out of this. But perhaps your ballot was delayed in Louis DeJoy's mailbox, but the margin was just 2% between 86 Donruss and the 82 Topps Kmart MVP set. 2%, 42 to 40. And then picking up the rear in this order, we had the 93 classic best minor league cards. We also had the combination of 1987 Donruss All-Star Pop-Ups and 1979 Topps Chewing Gum All-Star Wrappers. So these are just some of the unique things that I've found on eBay. So just for your own housekeeping purposes, here's the order of the shows that we're going to be doing over the next couple months, actually. So we've got 86 Donruss today by popular demand. In 2 weeks, on Friday, September the 11th, we will do a look at the 1982 Topps 25th anniversary set with Kmart. And I have threatened to do that for a long time, but seeing that 40% of the voters actually went with that, again, kind of surprised me. So rather than just kind of pushing it off to the back burner like I have been, we'll go ahead and get that going. That'll be our next show. And then in order, we're going to mix it up just a little bit. I'm going to insert a look back at 1961 Topps. So that'll be coming your way on September 25th. As we were challenged by one of our listeners to take a second look at the set. focus less on aesthetics, which I like to do, and really more about just the overall set. So I am totally fine with that. And as I've mentioned before, my collection of 61 tops has grown since the two or three cards that I had when we did the original 61 Top show back in 2017. And then looking ahead to October, what we'll do in order, we'll take a look at those other two options that were part of our poll, the 93 Classic Best Minor League cards. We'll take another look at how by 1993, and thanks in part to Classic Best, the minor league card market was completely bastardized by them. What was kind of a fun offshoot of the hobby was just totally destroyed in the early 90s as everybody got into the card hobby, and especially the minor league baseball side. And then we'll take a look at that unique combination of 87 Donruss All-Star pop-ups and the Topps All-Star chewing gum wrappers. This is when Topps took the Bazooka Joe chewing gum that they made, and instead of wrapping the gum with the Bazooka Joe comics, wrapped it with all-star stories, or stories of all-star players, I should say. It was actually a pretty neat idea that only lasted 1 year. And it's going to be pretty fun to open up that gum. I'm not going to eat it. I don't think so. But 41-year-old gum, I think it can wait a couple more months before we dive into that. So that's the plan, which is, of course, subject to change, and that'll be coming up soon. Now, real quickly, too, if you would like to support Wax Ecstatic, one of two ways you can do it. You can send us cardboard donations, whether you intend to have it discussed on the show, or if you prefer just to send me some classic cardboard just for my own personal collection. You know, I'd prefer that we, have stuff that is going to be discussed on the show, and perhaps some stuff that you send to me just for my personal enjoyment will become part of the show. That's always appreciated. My thanks to listener Mark Skoback, who's been sending me some small amounts, typically about 30 or 40 thoroughly beat up cards from the 1950s and 60s. But I'm a sucker for old baseball cards, and certainly I'm not going to go out and sell any of these, but always fun to look at those older cards. And I love sharing them with my son, and get to wow him with neat trivia like, hey, do you know which team is currently or was formerly known as the Colts? Looking at a 64 Topps card that was a Colts, and got to tell him the story of the Colt 45s becoming the Astros. Or as my very wise 10-year-old son calls them, the Asterisk. And you know why that is. So you can do cardboard donations. We've had some cardboard donations of 75 Topps that turned into a program. I've had plenty of 76 Topps, so I know we've visited that set a couple times. Maybe we do that once more. But we do appreciate those. Just please email me if you would like to make that donation. MattSammonSays@gmail.com. That's MattSammonSays@gmail.com. Just let me know what you're thinking of donating, because I don't want to just have a box of cards dropped on my doorstep. And then the other donation is a cash donation. I know people are still struggling to make ends meet, so I still move ahead with the soft sell here. If you would like to make a cash donation, paypal.me/waxecstatic is the address. And even a donation of just $5, it goes a long way here. And in fact, a lot of the cards that we're talking about here, the 86 Donruss, the Donruss pop-ups, the Topps chewing gum, the classic best cards, the 93 upper decks that we recently talked about, I was able to rather efficiently procure those items just through some small donations. And of course, if we're able to get a great deal on something that's a little harder to find that costs a few more bucks, that's where those donations go. Remember, too, whether it's cardboard donations or cash donations, it comes right back to the program here. Cash donations especially, you help us keep the lights on with audioboom.com and all the RSS feeds that pick up the broadcast. But also, you help us purchase those products. And again, excess product goes to our good friends at Commons for Kids. And I always suggest looking them up on Twitter. Their handle is Commons, the number 4, and Kids. So if you would like to make your donations to them, go ahead and do so. It's a great operation where the Commons, not just new stuff, but older stuff, all sports as well, and even some non-sports, they will take it at Commons for Kids and donate those cards to kids in need. And you're always looking for something good, something positive these days, and being able to gift kids with cards of their favorite teams or players or just sports to kind of get their mind off of everything else that's going on in their lives is definitely a good thing. Now, what was also a good thing was our past show on 93 Upper Deck, when I teased that we were talking about 93 Upper Deck, we automatically got a lot of response on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gumstains, including Bob Tona. I was waiting for you to do this set. It has some great photos, and that's something that we talked about at great length throughout the program. Zach Byrne as well. Can't wait to listen to this. This was one of the last sets I bought as a youngster, and yep, I'm 100% with you there, as you know, Zach. One other point here from Bob. He was talking more about the photographs, and he shared a picture of a couple of the cards, Sid Bream and also Charles Nagy. Nagy wearing a Cleveland Indians throwback uniform from probably the early 1930s. And they're autographed cards, and Bob had mentioned that he was working on getting some 93 Upper Deck cards signed by players. So that is certainly a fun way of, utilizing the cards, the junk wax cards, if you will. You know, they're certainly not junk, the 93 Upper Deck set. So being able to utilize those for part of your autograph collection. Also, Around the Mound mentioning, I still have about 15 packs left, and they're all bricks. Yeah, unfortunately, the UV coating, the downside there, as those cards would stick, certainly took about 50 cents of the dollar that I could have valued the Pedro Martinez card with. But still, it's an absolute blast to go ahead and open those up and look back at some of those great cards there. Speaking of great cards and great players, one of the players we highlighted, Roger McDowell, that got a lot of our listeners riled up. Of course, I shared the picture of the 93 Upper Deck card where McDowell had taken off his uniform shirt, and underneath it, he had this blue t-shirt that said Lasorda U. And Organic Card Farmer sent us a picture of the 94 Upper Deck Collector's Choice card with McDowell with a headband of Rambo. Is that the right look we're going for here? I don't know. Anyways, he has the headband on. He's got the very 1994-ish Ray-Bans going here. And he also has a tool belt with a sander and some drills. And it looks like he's got one of those disposable cameras. You remember those? The disposable Kodak cameras. You'd take the pictures, drop it off at your local drugstore, and they would develop the film there. And of course, you never got the camera back. You just got your pictures. They were pretty crappy pictures, too. I was never crazy about those disposable cameras. Anyways, here's Roger McDowell just yucking it up here. And as we noted, that was one of his favorite little dress-up games there during the days when teams were accusing other teams' pitchers of doctoring the balls. He would put on this tool belt with the sander and the drill bit and act like he was doctoring the balls in the bullpen. Now, also, we had a very interesting picture sent in from BMO, where he's standing next to Roger McDowell. McDowell, then the pitching coach of the Baltimore Orioles. And BMO is in Chicago in the White Sox Stadium. I hate calling it Guaranteed Rate Field. He's on the south side, and he's standing next to Roger McDowell. And BMO is holding this picture of himself and McDowell. Now, McDowell was with the Mets back then, so this would have been the late 1980s. And the picture of BMO and McDowell from probably 35 or so years ago is inscribed, Brian, my favorite Usher of all time. Thanks for all the good times in Chicago. And I'm guessing, Brian, you were an Usher at Wrigley Field. That's where this picture was taken. So pretty interesting story there. I would love to hear that at some point in time, Brian. But thank you very much for sharing that picture with us. And one other great card that was shared with us from Brian Krause, the 1973 Topps Fred Norman card. And again, check our timeline, Wax and Gum Stains, because you're going to love this picture if you don't know the card already. As I'm sure you're well aware of, the 1973 Topps set was a little over aggressive with action shots. And they started incorporating more action shots starting in the 71 set. In the 72 set, they had not a subset, but they would pair up star cards with, you know, the car or the star's name in action. So you would have Vida Blue's card, and then the next one in the series would be Vida Blue in action. So the normal base card would just be Vida Blue standing off to the side, like every other baseball card was designed, you know, in the previous 15 or so years. But then the in action card would show him delivering a pitch from the mound. So in 73, Topps wanted more and more action, which required not just more game shots, but often, as was the case, these wide angle shots, because the photographers, if they're not in a camera well, they were often, you know, pretty much in the front row of some of these stadiums. And that produced, in the, you know, limited technological advances of sports photography in the early 1970s, that produced some rather comical wide-angle shots. And many of the 73 Topps cards feature these action shots for one player, but there's typically three or four guys, or maybe, you know, the umpire's ass in the way. It's rather funny if you go looking through the 73 Topps set. And the Fred Norman card is one of my favorites because it is showing Norman in his gold 1972 San Diego Padres uniform just after he delivered a pitch. And you see the third baseman in the background. And then behind him, you see roughly, oh, probably 200 empty seats. There is absolutely nobody at Jack Murphy Stadium when Fred Norman was delivering this pitch. And Brian mentioned, looks like Fred Norman was already gearing up for the pandemic back in 1973, to which I replied, it is one of my favorite cards. I remember having this card, getting it when I was a teenager. And I remember just laughing at it because you talk about social distancing, you're absolutely right. But also, as the case is, this goes well into describing just how terrible of a situation Padres baseball was in 1972. And we discussed this at length when we talk about 74 Topps and the Washington National League goof-ups that are in the set, because the Padres were, as evidenced in this Fred Norman picture here, the Padres were just not even an afterthought. They were in a thought. Never mind an afterthought. Nobody thought about them. Nobody cared about them. They were getting run into the ground very quickly and were nearly relocated to Washington, D.C. So I think it's a great picture that summarizes, if you want to look at it in 2020 terms, that would be social distancing, or in 1972 terms, the god-awful San Diego Padres. This is a very great representative of that time, or representation of that time, I should say. Now, it still does not top my absolute favorite 73 Topps card, which we all know what that is. The great Luis Alvarado card, which features Alvarado at shortstop and some unknown second baseman for the Chicago White Sox in their spring training park, which was the Ramshackle Payne Park in Sarasota, Florida. And Payne Park was essentially a glorified community center. That was basically it. And the Alvarado card is classic because off to the side of the White Sox playing field, not just a practice field, the main playing field, was this parking lot. And it looks like a used car lot. And there's just a bunch of like 71 Grand Torinos here. And it doesn't do the late Luis Alvarado any good here. But it's definitely up there, whether it's Luis Alvarado or Fred Norman, some great laughably bad, not intentionally, but laughably bad cards and photos there in the attempt to try to get some action shots. Well, there were plenty of action shots in the 86 Donruss set, and like I said, I have always called this the Max Headroom set, but you can call it a Max Headroom set, you can call it an MTV set, you can call it Pee-wee's Playhouse, whatever you call it, it's got to have some kind of 1986 affiliation to it, not just because that's the year that the set was designed and released, but man, this captures, if you recall 1986, this just kind of captures just that New Coke, Reaganomic, I want my MTV kind of look and feel. It's got 86 Whitney Houston, New Shoes, Duran Duran. It's got everything in its look here. And the 86 Donruss set, like I said, it kind of has this diagonal vertical hold. And for those of you who are too young to know, and I'm laughing at this now because, you know, vertical holds and horizontal holds on televisions, I think they stopped putting those in there in the late 80s. I want to say by the early to mid 90s, television picture tubes were adjusted enough. And I think because more and more people had cable television by this time, television picture tubes were adjusted enough to where having issues with vertical hold and horizon hold was not a problem. But especially going back to the days of antenna television, you know, so pre-cable again, where you had the rabbit ears on your TV and you're trying to get, you know, the picture to come in from the local television station. Once you got it, sometimes the picture was coming in rather shaky. So you had to adjust these two little knobs at the bottom of your screen, the vertical hold and the horizontal hold. So the vertical hold would, you know, basically move the picture up and down, and the horizontal hold would move it left and right. So it was a fun trick to play with if you were, you know, messing with your brothers because they were watching something you didn't want to watch. But if you're trying to watch something that you did want to watch and you had trouble getting a good picture in, you're sitting there meticulously playing with these dials left and right. And often with televisions, the vertical hold and the horizontal hold had essentially the same effectiveness as the light versus dark adjuster on a toaster. Basically, not much at all. So you made the best of it. But sometimes if you had, you know, a really fuzzy picture coming in, it's very reminiscent of just kind of this background design on the 86 Donruss card, this blue, you know, light blue, dark blue diagonal lines going up and down the background of the card. So again, it's a Max Headroom feel, but it's also a very MTV look, very mid-80s look. And I think Donruss nails it, not just with the lines going up and down in the background, but also the diagonal cut of the photograph. For a set that gives up a lot of space to a border, which most collectors poo-poo, still there was enough of the card that was dedicated to the photograph. And that diagonal cut was not only very unique, that was something that was not done on baseball cards prior, at least from my memory, and I'm very quickly, you know, racking through my memory to think if any card actually did some kind of diagonal cut, and just off the top of my head, I don't believe so. So, you know, this was very unique. This was, I don't want to say state of the art, but certainly very on cue for what the look for 1986 Donruss was. And 86 Donruss also made a couple of subtle changes to its overall presentation. They got rid of the big clunky D logo, which had been there since 1981, and it's been resurrected since then under the Panini brand. But the Donruss look was a simple word mark, quite literally a word mark, where it says Donruss and then an apostrophe, and in this case 86. And Donruss would continue to have that look through 1991, and then they had this kind of upscale D logo that they introduced in 1992 when they upgraded their set to look more like one of those premium base sets that were becoming all the rage back then. So they made that tweak there, and also on the backs of the cards, kind of playing off the design change from 1985, where it was a little more of a subtle presentation, changing the color of the back of the cards from the goldenrod of 1985 to a light powder blue. And there is just something about that powder blue that works. For me, it's very reminiscent of 65 Tops, the backs of those cards, and I've always loved 65 Tops. There is a cool factor, and I don't mean like a radical cool. I'm talking about, you know, how you associate the light blue color with coolness, coldness, a drop in temperature. And I've always thought it looked great on 65 Tops. I think it looks great on 86 Donruss. Obviously, Donruss thought so too, because that color would be replicated again on the backs of 88 and 91 Series 1 Donruss. And it's a good look. And of course, Donruss had a very clean back. very basic information, player personal information, statistics as well, biographical highlights. The downside was, and Donruss was guilty of this for many, many, many years, they would have the five-year history of a player's major league record. And for a young player, for example, you know, we had a couple of young guys in the packs that we pulled, like Mike Gallego or Billy Bean. You've got guys that only had a year or two of major league experience. It works out rather well. But when you have a card like Reggie Jackson, which we had in that set, you know, here's Reggie Jackson, who had over 2,400 hits, over 500 home runs, was a member of five World Series champion teams, and in the twilight of his career here, you can't just boil it down to five lines in a career line, because really the greatness of Reggie Jackson, as we all know, and no offense to his to Angels fans or his time with the Angels, but Reggie Jackson's greatest moments did not come from 1981 through 1985. You know, it's coming up with age with the, you know, the swinging A's and, of course, the Mr. October days with the Yankees. And that's not even expressed, you know, anywhere in this brief snapshot, this rather cropped snapshot of his career. So that's always been the downside of how Donruss presented statistics and information on the backs of their cards. And they really did it for almost the entire early years. Certainly 1981, you had more of the bullet point timeline presentation. You had the cropped stats from 1982 through 1991. And even when they did upgrade the set in 1992 and 1993, you still had a very limited statistical breakdown. So while Donruss kept it clean and looking good, I think it was really a disservice to some great ball players that you could only look at 5 years of their stats. Now, that may not be much of a big deal now because we have the internet. We can look up anything on our phone. But again, let's remember pre-internet days. If you wanted to know a lot about a ball player, other than going to your local library or, you know, subscribing to Sports Illustrated or the Sporting News or any of those magazines at the time, this was your only connection, you know, unless you had the Bill James Encyclopedia. And most kids didn't, because that was a hefty, like $35 to buy. Then, you know, this was your portal to what these players had done. So it was rather unfortunate that those stats got lopped off, but that's just how Donruss did their presentation. And even though I never really liked it, I thought it was unique. It made them stand out. They were different from Topps and Fleer, and of course, later on, Score and Upper Deck as well. So the 86 Donruss set, great looking set from the time, and it is loaded down with some notable rookies. Now, as I was saying before, the Jose Canseco card is the biggest of the rookies, and it certainly was throughout the late 1980s. I remember that was a chase card. People were looking for that Canseco rookie. It was selling at the time, you know, upper double digits. If you had a mint card, you could sell it for $100. Not so much these days. I've seen the prices on some of the Canseco cards. You know, if you have a PSA 8 or 9, you could sell it for around $50. PSA 10s, you know, will push it over $100. But, you know, I think an ungraded Canseco card will cost you maybe $5 at a card show or a card store, maybe even less. It depends on how many the store owner has. But still, that Canseco card, number 39, one of the few rated rookies that hit for Donruss, it's still one of the key cards, if not the key card from the set. Now, speaking of rated rookies that hit, and we've discussed before how rated rookies were often swing and miss, and other card companies had that too with their prospect cards. But Donruss was notoriously bad. You know, when they missed, boy, did they miss. But some of the hits that they had in the 86 set include my buddy Fred McGriff, also the big cat Andrés Galarraga, and crank red ass Paul O'Neill, all featured in the rated rookie cards. And then you had a couple of other rookie cards that didn't get the rated rookie brand, but are also of note. That, of course, Cecil Fielder and the late great Dutch Darren Dalton. So you've got some really good rookie cards. Just like every other set from 1986, you've got great early career cards. So you've got Roger Clemens, you've got Daryl Strawberry, you've got Doc Gooden, We had Brett Saberhagen in one of the packs that we opened up, which again, you know, 30 years ago would have been worth something. And you've also got Ripken and Sandberg and Gwynn and Boggs, those guys. And then, of course, you've got the players who were still stars from the mid to late 70s. So the usual bunch of Brett and Yount and Trammell and Molitor and that bunch there. And, of course, you also have very, very late career cards of some Hall of Famers such as Steve Carlton, also Phil Niekro, Pete Rose as well, even though technically he's not a Hall of Famer. But, you know, you've got quite the collection of quality players, along with your usual common cards. But you've got a great design, a great look front and back, pretty good card stock, and a pretty good crop of players across the board here. Again, rookies, young stars, and Hall of Fame veterans. So when you put that all together, you got yourself one hell of a set here. And boxes are pretty affordable. I have seen unwrapped boxes. So this is the true factory box of 86 Domruss, going for as low as $20 in some cases, although I think the average price from what I've seen is closer to the $35 or $40 range. That's kind of the going rate for, you know, an 86 Tops box now. The 86 boxes are starting to fetch a little more of a premium here as we are starting to approach 35 years since 1986. That'll be accomplished next year. And, you know, once you get up to 35 years, then you start looking at, you know, kind of a vintage status, which is hard to believe. That's a sign that you're growing old. You know, it's kind of like when you hear a song from high school on the classic rock station. You're like, no, 1986 isn't vintage. It was 86. It was Elf. It was Perfect Strangers. It was Dire Straits, Money for Nothing. That's not vintage. Although that's been, you know, played on classic rock stations ad nauseum for about 30 years, but I digress. So you can get some true factory boxes for anywhere from $20 to about $40, $45. But I have also seen via auction sealed boxes, and whether that's just sealed with plastic wrap or marked by PSA, BBCE, or any of those authenticators, that you can get around $100 to $150 for that box. And people will pay for it because, again, of that solid rookie class. And also, this is one of those sets that, because it's 1986, yes, it was produced in larger numbers than card sets from the 60s or 70s, but we weren't quite at the wax junk wax era just yet. I always put that demarcation point at 1988. It really just seems like that's when everything went overboard. So you've got a great set, looks good, great stars, still fairly affordable. While I was slapping myself on the wrist and telling myself not to hand collate this set, because I've got enough from 1975 through 86. Thank you very much. Let's keep our eyes on the prize and get as many of these sets done, Mr. Salmon. I would recommend, though, that 86 Donruss, if you wanted to splurge, $40 or $45 on a box, could be a fun set to put together. And again, at 660 cards, much easier, generally speaking, a little less frustrating with 132 fewer cards than what you had with Tops at that time. Still the same size as the Fleer set, but 86 Donruss, an absolute winner. Love it. Always have loved it. And, you know, even when you get the Leaf cards, and that's happened to me before where I thought I was buying a Donruss pack on eBay, but it was actually a Leaf. And, you know, no offense to our friends north of the 49th parallel, but getting the Leaf baseball cards or the OPG baseball cards, to me, that was always like, you know, getting the Canadian quarter in the vending machine change slot. You know, it's a quarter, but it's really worth about 20 cents, you know, with the exchange rate. Same thing here. You know, hey, it's a baseball card, oh, but it's Leaf. You know, you can kind of hear the sad trombone. Wow, I got this pack from 1985. Oh, it's OPG. Now, of course, if you're collecting hockey cards, it's the other way around. You wanted OPG versus Tops. But even the 86 Leaf cards are good enough in design to where I had no problem looking at those. Plus, I was able to brush up on my French as well. So 86 Donruss is a great set. Still affordable, still relatively easy to collect. Great selection of rookies, young stars, and veterans as well. And if you are interested in spending a little money on a box or maybe two, you've got a pretty neat little set that you can put together through that. And even if it's not for, you know, resale value that you're looking at, I think it's still got a lot of value in terms of just the design and its place in history. I do believe that you could say that 86 Donruss is the best set from 1986. Again, my soft spot's always with Fleer. I thought Fleer just really had great set after great set after great set from 83 to 87. But, you know, Donruss, I think, is right there. I think they're neck and neck. And we've talked a lot about 86 Tops, and 86 Tops still has a strong hold, even though it's not the best set out there. But I really do think that you could argue that Donruss is the number one set. Yeah, you could have a pretty good debate over which of those three sets, or if you wish to include Sports Flicks, which are the four sets from 1986, do rank up there. Now, we've got a pretty interesting collection of cards here from the 1986 Donruss set that I pulled randomly here, but it's so funny as I'm doing the research on these particular players, there's a lot of crisscrossing here. You're going to find out that actually three of the four players that I have here do have something in common. They all somehow, some way ended up, you know, either getting traded for one another or rooming with one another, or ultimately playing for the Minnesota Twins at some point in time in the mid to late 1980s. And let's start with Chris Pitaro. I remember as I'm going through this wax pack and pulling out the Chris Pitaro, I'm like, well, there's a name that's just kind of slipped off the radar for many, many years. And Chris Pitaro was a very talented infielder, was a star at Steinert High School in Mercer County, New Jersey, later played baseball for North Carolina with the Tar Heels, and was also a relatively high draft pick by the Detroit Tigers, a sixth rounder, 152nd overall in 1982, drafted as a shortstop. And that right there means that the road to the major leagues is going to be a very long one for Chris Pitaro, because much like being the shortstop for the Rochester Red Wings from 1982 to 1996 was a thankless job because, well, there was some guy named Cal Ripken in front of you in Baltimore. If you were a shortstop in the pipeline for the Detroit Tigers, you only had Alan Trammell in front of you for many, many years. And as long as Trammell and Whitaker were just cranking away, turning the double plays in the middle of the infield for the mid, actually pretty much all the 1980s, the hopes of you actually cracking through the lineup in Detroit in the mid-80s were practically none to slightly none. So he's drafted as a shortstop and, of course, gets moved to second base. Well, all right, so in most cases that would be helpful. But again, you only have Lou Whitaker at second base. So, you know, again, it's a thankless job, but you keep climbing the ladder, right? You just keep working your way up, and that's what he did. And Pitaro gets invited to Tiger spring training in Lakeland, Florida in 1985. And that's where the loquacious Sparky Anderson calls Pitaro the best rookie he'd seen in 15 years. Now that is a hell of a compliment. And think about it, 1985. So over 15 years, you're going back to 1970. Oh, that's Sparky's first year with the Big Red Machine. So you got to think of some of the rookies and some of the young stars that Sparky had seen with Cincinnati in the 70s, with the Tigers in the early 80s. So to be anointed the best rookie that Sparky Anderson had seen in 15 years, that's not only a hell of a compliment, but that is a terrible kiss of death. Because the expectations, phew. So not only are you behind both Lou Whitaker and Alan Trammell in Detroit in 1985, But you've got Sparky squawking off here saying that you're this phenomenal player. Now, we also know why Sparky is doing this. First, it does light a fire under the asses of Whitaker and Trammell. And, you know, they don't get, complacent after winning a World Series in 1984. But Sparky's the ultimate salesman, too. He knows that by talking great things about Chris Pitaro as being this great prospect, he's putting a sale price on Chris Pitaro, so that when the time comes that the Tigers are going to trade him, and you know they will, they can fetch something pretty good back. So Pitaro actually makes the Tigers roster out of spring training. He's platooning with Tom Brookins around the infield, and he makes his major league debut April 8th, 1985. And of course, this is when the Tigers are celebrating winning their World Series the day before. What an introduction. And he's just clobbering the ball in April, however, starts going downhill shortly thereafter. And he gets demoted to the Tigers AAA club, which was in Nashville at that time, and pretty much finishes the season in Nashville. So what did I say about being sold here, you know, having Sparky say so many great things that you're going to, you know, get something back in return? Well, that's exactly what the Tigers got, as right before the 1986 season. So, you know, here's Pitaro featured with the Tigers. Well, he's not even with the Tigers, because Pitaro, along with Alejandro Sanchez, is traded to the Minnesota Twins for Dave Engel. And while Dave Engel certainly wasn't a great player, Dave Engel was somebody that Sparky and the Tigers could actually move around the field a little bit. Engel would only play 1 year in Detroit, but he was the ultimate utility player. He was an outfielder. You can put him as a catcher. He was a good designated hitter too, especially later on in his career. 262 average hitter, all-star for the Twins in 84. So as opposed to just having this backup to Whitaker and Trammell, you have this guy that you can just kind of move around into every position. So Sparky got what Sparky wanted by putting Pitaro on this unbelievably high pedestal. He was able to get a piece that he was able to utilize. So Pitaro goes to the Twins, who are rebuilding at this time. And as a backup infielder, he's just playing miserably. In fact, he was batting .095 before getting demoted to AAA. Toledo was the farm club for the Twins at that time. So he's going back and forth between the big leagues and AAA in 1987. The AAA team for the Twins at that time is the Portland Beavers. And he's really struggling here. Didn't make the Twins roster in 1988. Goes back to Portland and basically retires as a professional ball player. Now, what's interesting about Chris Pitaro is shortly after his playing career ended, he joined the Oakland Athletics organization as a scout in 1991. Now, who was somebody who helped open the door to the executive offices in the Oakland Athletics? None other than his former roommate in Portland, a gentleman by the name of Billy Bean. Now, there's often confusion when it comes to Billy Bean, where you have Billy Bean, the executive with the Oakland Athletics, and then Billy Bean, one of the first players to come out as homosexual. And of course, he's written a lot of books and has become a beacon of the LGBTQ plus crowd. Let me tell you what the difference is. Billy Bean with the E at the end, that is the executive. So think of that E as executive or efficiency. They both fit the Billy Bean we're talking about. And what's interesting is we have the Billy Bean card in this group of 86 Domruss packs. So we'll get to Billy Bean's story in just a little bit, but let's wrap up the thoughts of Pitaro. So Pitaro joins the A's organization in 1991. Of course, he and Bean reimagine how the front office works as part of the whole Moneyball idea. He has also been moved up from scout to national field coordinator, later the club's director of professional scouting. And since 2011, he has been special assistant to the general manager. Of course, Billy Bean. Another interesting point here of Pitaro. His father, Sonny Pitaro, was also a member of the Minnesota Twins organization. He was an infielder, played only in the minor leagues in the early 1960s, and later would become a coach at Rider University. And also Pitaro, this is an interesting personal note, is married to Lisa Ginter, former soccer player, U.S. national team member as well. So again, with common cards, there's not a common story. You may flip through these cards and go, Chris Pitaro, who the hell is that? So even though Chris Pitaro didn't get much of a whiff at the major leagues as a player, boy, he was obviously a very good roommate, must have shared the remote nicely, didn't snore too loudly at the, you know, Motel Sixes throughout the Pacific Northwest while he was in Portland, because latching on with Billy Beane, he was able to make quite a career out of it. Now let's talk to Billy Beane. And again, this is Billy Beane, the Moneyball Billy Beane, not Billy Beane, the other former player who also played at roughly the same time. You know, Beane publicly came out as gay back in 1999, and there's a lot of confusion because both Billy Beanes played pretty much at the same time in the late 1980s. Now, this Billy Beane is William Lamar Beane III, who is a native of the Orlando, Florida area. And let's go ahead and pick up his story as well, as he was also a star high school player, in fact, a multi-sport player. He starred in baseball, basketball, and football. And in fact, he was such a good football player as a quarterback that he was recruited by Stanford University because they thought Billy Beane would be the throne successor, the heir apparent, if you will, to John Elway. Of course, John Elway, the quarterback at Stanford, also played baseball. Perhaps you've heard the stories, you know, courted by George Steinbrenner and the Yankees while he was basically telling the Baltimore Colts to stick it. And they eventually sent him over to Denver. And the rest, as they say, is history. Now, the dual sport ability of Billy Beane, however, scared off a lot of suitors. And that's because of John Elway. Elway opting to play football rather than baseball, and the Yankees basically burned a draft pick with the Elway pick here. Of course, George didn't mind because he got to get some headlines out of it. So it's the other New York team, the Mets, that are interested in drafting Beane in the 1980 Major League Baseball draft. And the Mets had the first overall pick, but they also had a 23rd overall pick. So the Mets decided to take a flyer on Beane with that second first round pick. That way, if Beane opted to play football, then for them, it wasn't that big of a deal. They were still going to cash in with that first overall pick, which was, by the way, Daryl Strawberry. So they made the right choice there, grabbing Strawberry. Beane did actually fall to the 23 spot, so they pick him up there. And Beane decided he didn't want his career to end through a football injury, so he decided to pursue baseball. And the Mets, believe it or not, saw Billy Beane as a higher prospect than Daryl Strawberry. That sounds completely foreign these days, but that's just their view in 1980. So while Strawberry was starting out in rookie ball, the Mets fast-tracked Beane to the Class A New York Penn League straight out of college. Well, that did not help Beane, as he couldn't make the adjustment from playing for Stanford to playing Class A. It was just too big of a jump there. And in fact, he really struggled, batting .210 in his first season. Still, the Mets started moving him up and up the ladder here, but then he started to stall around Double A. Meanwhile, think of the Mets again, early 80s as they're building up here. Well, you've got guys like Strawberry advancing. You've got Lenny Dykstra advancing. You've got so many of these other players who would be key parts of that 86 World Championship team just buzzing right past him in the depth chart, that, you know, here's Billy Beane going, okay, you know, am I really good enough to play in Major League Baseball? Well, he finally got a cup of coffee in the 1984 season. He played five games for the Mets. And then in 1985, again, spends most of his time in AAA, plays eight games for the Mets then. And he was still a star at AAA, but still wasn't quite able to convert that into stardom at the major league level. So much like our buddy Chris Pitaro, who's featured in a Tigers uniform on his 86 Donruss card, Billy Bean, with his Mets uniform, is no longer with the Mets when the 1986 season starts. And that's because during the winter of 1985, Bean is traded along with Joe Klink and Bill Latham to the Minnesota Twins for Tim Tuffel, Pat Crosby, and a minor league player. Of course, Tuffel would be a key utility player for the Mets, not only in 86, but for some of those contending teams in following years. So Bean was going to be the starting left fielder for the Twins in 1986, but he was dealing with injuries. He was also still struggling. In fact, in 80 games with the Twins in 1986, bats only .216. So he starts split in time, much like Chris Pitaro, going between major leagues and AAA. And of course, during this time, Bean and Pitaro are making their friendship a real thing here, which would pay dividends for both for many years. But there's one more footnote here to Bean's playing career. After the 1987 season, Bean is traded to the Detroit Tigers for Balvino Galvez. So once again, we've got a Tiger connection here with Chris Pitaro. And wait, there will be more. Oh, by the way, we've got lots of Tigers and Twins connections today. So he makes the opening day roster in 1988 as an injury fill-in, but eventually goes back to AAA. And then he is eventually moved to the Oakland Athletics, in fact, as a free agent. He becomes a free agent in 1988, goes to Oakland. He appears in 37 games with the Athletics in 1989. Resigns with the team for the 1990 season, but never made the major league roster again. So by the early 1990s, he's getting tired of, you know, the minor league lifestyle, but also the ups and downs too. Like, think about, especially when the Twins had their farm team in Portland, you're getting called up and sent back down. You're going from bus rides in Portland and the Pacific Northwest back to the big leagues in Minnesota, back and forth and back and forth. It gets old after a while. And of course, at this time too, following the 1990 season, he is approaching 29 years old. You're thinking, okay, you know, I just need a little bit of a change up here. And you think too of that Oakland Athletics team in 1990. There's no way a utility guy like Billy Bean is going to really make any kind of an impact on that just star-studded team back then. So he approaches Sandy Alderson, the general manager of the A's, and asked to become an advanced scout. And Alderson makes him an advanced scout. And that was a position that Bean would hold through 1993 when he was promoted to the assistant general manager position. So again, the Pitaro and Bean timeline, it takes off from here. And eventually, Bean becomes the general manager in October of 1997. And starts up with the whole Moneyball methodology of putting together a team. Now, Moneyball wasn't just Billy Bean's idea. He was the one who was able to make the best of it. It was actually Alderson who, because of very tight payrolls, had to, you know, make the best with what he could find and try to make the A's a competitive team. You know, long gone were the free spending days of the late 80s and early 90s when the A's were at their best. So when Alderson moved on, Bean takes over, and he is able to make the best out of a pretty thin payroll with some very talented players. And the A's were contenders for much of the early 2000s, and they still are contenders to this day. Now, at the same time, I've made the argument, well, what has Moneyball won for the Oakland A's since 1990? Or what has Moneyball won for the Minnesota Twins since 1992? And yes, I know the Florida Marlins of 2003, they were definitely a Moneyball-style team. Not completely, though. There were some somewhat big contracts there. But I've never been a huge fan of Moneyball. I think that there is a smart way to assemble a team. And yes, maybe it's with sabermetrics. Yes, maybe it's, you know, signing that guy off the scrap heap and seeing some of those contracts as low risk, high reward if the player pans out. But I've never been a big proponent. I've never been a big proponent of Moneyball. I've never promoted it. That's where I was combining the two. But I've never been big on it just because I think the lack of results speaks for itself. Yes, you do have those odd instances where a Moneyball team has succeeded or has contended. But to me, it's, you know, it's a broken clock being right twice a day. That's kind of what it is here. So Bean still, however, continues to operate the Oakland Athletics. Again, he is the not the general manager anymore. He's the executive vice president of baseball operations. David Forst, excuse me, became the general manager back in 2015. And Pitaro, as I mentioned, still part of the A's organization. And it's so funny, too, how Billy Bean was sought after by a lot of teams, including the Boston Red Sox. Before they hired Theo Epstein, Bean was offered the position to become the GM in Boston, but he declined. And it's so funny how things turned out. The A's kind of dipped a little bit for a few years. And of course, Epstein and the Red Sox became a thing in 2004 and 2007. So it's kind of funny, you know, Billy Bean and missed opportunities like that with Boston, but also how he was able to make the best of opportunities. And I think, you know, his major league career ended at the right time. Alderson offered him that job as a scout. Bean totally got the idea behind what Alderson and the A's were trying to do with Moneyball. And often it's Bean who is credited with it. And as much as I'm not a big fan of Moneyball, I can also say that what Billy Bean has over me is that I have never had Brad Pitt play my part in any kind of movie. So, you know, all right, so Bean's got that going for him. All right, let's talk about another player who has this Minnesota Twins connection here, and this was not by design. This is just how it happened, random selections here. One of the great 1980s baseball names, and if you live in the Twin Cities, you'll remember this guy because, boy, did he just come out of nowhere and perform for the Twins in the 87 World Series. Of course, talking about Steve Lombardozzi, and that's a name when you got the card out of the pack, you're like, oh, it's Steve... No, it's the great Steve Lombardozzi, who was from the Malden, Massachusetts area, and was a top athlete, was a receiver of an athletic scholarship to Florida, the University of Florida in Gainesville. So he was able to play for some of the top teams for the Florida Gators in the early 1980s. Also attended Gulf Coast Community College in previous years as well. So going through the JUCO route to the SEC, he was first team all Southeastern Conference, and he also had SEC all tournament honors in 1981. He was selected in the ninth round of the 81 draft by the Twins. So he climbs up through their system and very quickly makes his major league debut with the Twins in July of 1985. And spent most of the 85 season in AAA with Toledo, but did get a pretty good look in the 85 season. Now, he comes out of the Twins camp in 1986 as the starting second baseman for the team. And like I said, in 1987, he's one of the unsung heroes. You know, you think of the 87 Twins. Who do you think of? Well, of course, Sweet Music. You got Frank Viola. You've got Ken Urbeck, you've got Kirby Puckett, you know, all those guys that surprised the world with that championship 87 team. Well, there was no bigger surprise than the World Series performance of Lombardozzi, as in that seven-game series against the Cardinals, he led all hitters for the Twins, actually not just the Twins, all hitters in the World Series for both teams, with a .412 batting average. And he also hit a key home run off of Bob Forsch in game one of that series. So he was just a massive factor in the 87 series, delivers the game-winning run in game six, game-winning hit, I should say. It was an RBI. He wasn't the runner. But he hit the game-winning hit in the fifth inning of an 11-6 Twins victory. And again, .412, just incredibly impressive for a guy whose career batting average was .233. Now, all good things have to come to an end, though. He started the 88 season as the starting second baseman. However, despite his quality glove, he was a gold glove nominee. You know, he was certainly one of the top fielders. He still had troubles at the plate. And after that great 87 World Series, his numbers slip in 1988 and 1989. In fact, he only hit 209 in 1989. So the Twins are trying to make a fix there. So they bring in Tommy Herr, also Wally Backman, and Lamardazzi eventually is platooning with these guys. And eventually the Twins trade him to the Houston Astros at the start of the 1989 season for minor league outfielder Roman Cedeno. Now, Lamardazzi, despite the new environs, can't make the best of it. First of all, veteran second baseman Bill Doran is anchored in at second base, and of course eventually the Astros would move their young catcher Craig Biggio to second, and he only made a Hall of Fame career out of it. So also getting tired of the shuttling from major leagues to AAA in 1990, he decides that he's done with it, and so are the Astros. They release him midway through the 1990 season. He signs with Detroit, again, a Detroit connection here in our cards, and was eventually designated to AAA Toledo, where he spent the rest of the 1990 season, and then he would retire. Now, after his retirement, he focused on his family, coached youth baseball as well, spending lots of quality time with his two children, including... yes, the Lombardazzi name was showing up in the major leagues again, as Steve Jr. would eventually make it to the big leagues, as he would play parts of six seasons earlier in the past decade with Washington, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and Miami. His last major league season was with the Marlins in 2017, and at last check, he was with the Long Island Ducks of the Atlantic League of Professional Baseball. Now, as for his father, Steve Sr., not only did he help, put a nice little pathway for Steve Jr. to the big leagues, but also he was hired by the Pittsburgh Pirates to be a minor league fielding coordinator, and was also a first base and infield coach. So the Lombardazzis, while Steve Sr. had that moment in the sun in 1987, still contributing to the big leagues, not only as a coach and a coordinator, but also again with his son playing for parts of six seasons and still playing professionally now with Long Island. Last but not least, Jason Thompson. So here we go. We've got another Detroit Tiger tie in here. But I point out Jason Thompson for a couple of reasons. One, as I pointed out in the video, his card is just spectacular, because apparently the Pirates, in whatever game Thompson was playing in, likely in 1985, whatever game he was playing in here, the equipment manager must have just had a jumbled up day with the uniforms, because by 1985, 86, the Pirates are winding down their Bumblebee, we are family, Willie Stargell, mix up of jerseys that came around in 1976. And of course, were popularized in that 79 World Series run. And the Bumblebee jerseys of the 1970s and early 1980s featured some very unique combinations. And the card that Jason Thompson, or the picture of, on Jason Thompson's card, is one of the most unique combinations I have ever seen, because Thompson is wearing the bright gold helmet. You have the white no stripe top and the black pants with gold trim. So if 86 Donruss is very representative of just the helter skelter MTV days of 1986, so is the Pirates uniform combination this particular day. And of course, Thompson looks a little awkward too. He's right after he hit the ball here, so he's kind of like almost down on one knee here. But I picked Thompson not only because of that, but also because Thompson is one of those very powerful hitters from the late 70s and early 80s that has, generally speaking, just kind of gotten lost in the test of time here. And I think Thompson doesn't get much of the credit he deserves. First of all, he didn't have great numbers, certainly not like Hall of Fame worthy numbers, but he was a crowd pleaser because he could hit some mammoth home runs, especially in the old Tiger Stadium. Now, he was born and raised in the Hollywood, California area, was actually drafted by the hometown Dodgers in 1972, but he opted to not sign with them, decided to play ball at Cal State Northridge. So the Tigers take him in the fourth round of the 1975 Major League Draft. Now, he very quickly moves up through the Tigers farm system. And of course, the Tigers were not a very good team. They were definitely going through a rebuild in the mid-1970s. Makes his debut in April of 1976, thanks in part to one of our favorite Tigers, Disco Dan Meyer, hitting a woeful 192 to start the 1976 season. So when Thompson makes his debut, he goes 4-for-5. In his third game as a major leaguer. It wasn't his debut, but he started setting the trend for the Tigers at the time that, yeah, you made the right decision here. And even though he only hit .218 in 1976, he also had 17 home runs, had 54 RBI, and was named to the Topps Rookie All-Star team. And he would also defensively be pretty solid at first base as well. In 1977, batting .276, 12 home runs, 65 RBI at the All-Star break, he's actually named to the American League All-Star team. Didn't appear in the game, however, but he did also appear in the 1978 All-Star game in San Diego and actually did appear, had one at bat, which he flew out in. He would also be an All-Star in 1982. With the Pirates. Now, in 1979, one of those mammoth home runs I was talking about, actually, this was a mammoth foul ball. He hit a foul ball over the roof in foul territory in right field, completely out of Tiger Stadium. And he often hit home runs either on or over the right field roof at Tiger Stadium. And that, of course, earned him the rather appropriate nickname of Rooftop, because this was a guy that could consistently launch them out of the field here. Now, even though he was a fan favorite because he hit some big home runs, he was not a very consistent hitter. And by 1980, the Tigers are starting to get better players coming up through their farm system. So after a slow start, he's traded to the California Angels for Al Cowens. No, not AC Al Cowens, the late Al Cowens, which Brad Blukjan featured in the Wax Pack book. So with the Angels, he has a very brief time there. He is supposed to replace the legendary Rod Carew at first base, as the Angels decide to move Carew to the designated hitter position. Well, you don't replace Rod Carew. Rod Carew's like, I ain't taking that stuff. So Carew is able to boost his numbers, and eventually it's Carew at first base, and Thompson becomes the designated hitter. So even though he hit over 300 for the Angels, again, looking to get some spare parts here for a little bit of a mini contention run in the early 80s. So they trade him to Pittsburgh in spring training 1981 for Mickey Mahler and Ed, don't call me, Mel Ott. Now, the Pirates were going to flip Thompson to the Yankees for Jim Spencer and also minor league pitchers Greg Cochran and player to be named later, Fred Tolliver, who is also in this 86 Donruss pack. But as Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner at that time, was butting heads with George Steinbrenner, Kuhn voids the trade because the Yankees were going to pay Spencer's 1981 salary. Well, that put the transaction over a limit that Kuhn had established for any transaction. The limit was $400,000. And that, of course, was partially to try to quell the big teams, the big dollar teams, from hoarding all of the talent. And this was, you know, again, kind of a response by Kuhn to try to limit teams like the Yankees or Dodgers from overspending, as you had the beginnings of free agency playing out here by 1980 and 1981. It would have been, year 4 and 5 of free agency. So by putting limits on transactions, it was almost kind of like a faux salary cap, if you will. So that deal gets nixed, and rather than joining a potential contender, the Yankees' one last gasp, as it would be in 1981, poor Jason Thompson is stuck with the cocaine-addled Pittsburgh Pirates of the early 80s. So he's obviously not feeling good about his situation. Hits only 171 in the first half of the strike bifurcated season, However, comes back to life in the second half, hits .321 with 8 home runs and 25 RBI. As I mentioned, he was an all-star for the Pirates in 1982. In fact, was hitting .354 through the month of May, so he got his nod to the all-star game in Montreal that season. He would hit 4 home runs in a doubleheader against the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field in June of 1984, would tie Ralph Kiner's 37-year-old franchise record for most home runs in a doubleheader. And even though he was still being productive in 1985, much like the Tigers, much like the Angels, having better, younger prospects coming up through the system, well, the Pirates certainly had that happening in the mid-80s as well. So during the spring of 1986, he's traded to the Montreal Expos for 2 minor leaguers, where Thompson again runs into the better, younger, cheaper prospect problem as some kid named Andrés Galarraga. Yes, the big cat, also featured with his rated rookie card here in the 86 Donruss set. He basically pushes Thompson out of a job here. He was released by the Expos in June of 1986, and he decided not to sign on anywhere else because of not only his age and because things were winding down, but also because of some constant knee injuries too. So there you go, Jason Thompson. And I like bringing up his story because, again, he's just one of those really good players, and certainly not great, was never part of any World Series team, was never, a headline player. Certainly you had better first basemen. Certainly you had more notable power hitters that were playing at that time. But he certainly found a niche, first with Detroit, briefly with California, later with Pittsburgh, of being a clutch hitter, a guy that could get you that big bomb when you needed it. And what's interesting is through 11 major league seasons, he did play over 1,400 games, had 208 home runs, 782 RBI, and over 1,200 hits. So, you know, it's not like this guy had a shabby career. He was actually able to string together a pretty good career. Just didn't get a lot of attention because he was playing for some, for the most part, terrible teams. The Tigers were rebuilding and up and coming. The Pirates were rebuilding and up and coming. And his brief forays with the Angels and Expos, they were contending teams. They just had some better, younger players that were coming up through the system. Or again, in the Angels situation, you know, just Rodney Carew not wanting to give up his spot at first base in the 1980 season. But a 3-time All-Star, and often overlooked. Currently, he is the owner and operator of the appropriately titled Jason Thompson Baseball, which is an instruction baseball instruction camp and business in the suburbs of Detroit in Auburn Hills. Well, that'll do it for our looks at 1986 Donruss and some very interesting players that were part of that set. And some great stories, too. And again, you know, the common players, these may be common cards, but certainly no common stories. Whether you become this, executive extraordinaire like Billy Beane, or you become the executive extraordinaire's assistant because you roomed with him like Chris Pitaro did, or maybe you have that one shining moment like Steve Lombardozzi, or you were an unsung hero like Jason Thompson. So many great stories from what I believe is one of the great sets of 1986, and you could argue the greatest of the three major sets that were produced that year. Now, a not so great set, but one that is clearly fondly remembered by our listeners, and even one listener telling me that the 82 Topps Kmart sets were handed out like candy back at Halloween. Well, you can still get it for less than the price of a pack of candy these days. We're going to look at the much criticized, much poo-pooed 1982 Topps Kmart 20th anniversary MVP set. And even though a lot of collectors snub their nose at it because there's practically no value because Kmart and Topps made so many of them you could hand them out like candy, they still deserve a rather notable footnote in the history of baseball cards. Not because it was a great set, not because it was a set that is worth tens of thousands of dollars these days, But for a couple of reasons. One, it was one of the most popular co-op sets, and co-op sets were actually very big in the late 70s and early 80s. Kmart was also in 1982, arguably one of the biggest retail names in North America at that time. I think you could say it would rival Sears and Montgomery Ward and JCPenney at that time. But there was kind of a dark side as Kmart was kind of getting complacent and just cranking out baseball cards. You had Walmart sneaking up on them. And I think the other big reason why it deserves some credit is, again, life pre-internet. This was a great way to learn the history of baseball. And that would be learning the history of the American League and National League MVPs from 1962 through 1981. Even if Topps had to make up some baseball cards to feature on these cards. That's right. In a day and age where people scream fake news at something that isn't legit, Topps had to make fake baseball cards for these real baseball cards. We'll give you the details of that in our next show, which again will be coming 2 weeks from now, Friday, September the 11th. I'm Matt Salmon. I'm your host. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Also, make your donations to the program. Cardboard donations, email me, mattsalmonsays@gmail.com. Cash donations, always appreciated. PayPal.me/waxecstatic. We will see you next time, 2 weeks from now, for the next Wax Ecstatic. Have a great day.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.